Hello, and a welcome to the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. Today is Wednesday, March 30th. I'm Matt Weaver, and I'm here with Scott Nelson. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
How you doing?
I am doing well. How about you?
Great. It's raining today. I think a week ago it was snowing. It's clearly springtime in the Midwest.
And yesterday before it started raining, it was like 60 degrees and sunny.
It was beautiful yesterday. So let's dive right in. Let's talk about the Gates Foundation 2016 annual letter, which I know, you know, came out a couple months ago, but I just kind of tripped across it a week or two ago. And, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates write a letter every year, an open letter, you know, effectively to the world, as part of their charitable work with their foundation. And this year, they talked about two things. Bill talked about the world needs more energy, and Melinda talked about the world needs more time. And that bit about energy really kind of intrigued me. I ended up down the rabbit hole of internet reading, thinking about it and talking about it. I don't know. Which part of the annual letter did you find most interesting?
So I thought the energy part was very interesting. It drove me to read some stuff about conservation and about, you know, micro energy conservation, which got me thinking about my personal energy usage. My personal energy usage has seemed to trend upward over the last few years, mostly as a result of more and more devices plugged in at my house constantly. When I talk about energy usage, I'm not talking about like travel or driving or fossil fuels. I'm just like electricity used in my house seems to be on an upward trend.
Have you verified this against your utility bills?
Yes. Yeah, that's what I mean. In my neighborhood, they publish this thing that compares you against your neighbors and your energy consumption. And whereas I used to be a good guy, you know, I got the smiley face, you're one of the most energy efficient in your neighborhood. Then it went to your average. And now sometimes I'm even like less efficient than all of my neighbors, apparently.
Has your usage really changed, or has...
Do you think other people's has gone down?
Yeah.
Could be. I mean, just looking at kilowatt hour expenditure, my usage has gone up.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure. I haven't made a decision yet what exactly I'm going to do about it. If I'm going to do a full-on energy audit, if I'm just going to go around and start unplugging things, if I'm going to think about, you know, changing out my air conditioning system or something like that. I haven't made any final decisions yet, but I feel like I should do something.
Presumably all of these things that are plugged in and using electricity at your house provide some useful and valuable service for you. I mean, obviously if something's plugged in and wasting energy because it provides nothing valuable or interesting to you, then unplugging it is clearly the right answer. But if it's doing something valuable for you, why would you unplug it?
Well, part of it is I have like 5 computers plugged in and running all the time in my house now.
So?
That's maybe not necessary. I have an Apple TV and a Roku and a DVD player, and I feel like over time I just keep adding more and more devices. I have a Kindle I charge and an iPhone I charge and a, you know.
Stuff. It is, I have read that the refrigerator is usually one of the highest consumers of electricity in most people's homes. How old is your refrigerator?
About 10 years.
Yeah, see, mine's 20 or more. I've looked at getting solar panels on my house, and the part of thinking about is it worth the money to invest in solar panels on your roof involves how much energy do you use and where do you use it? And for me, it would be, I would get a much better return on the money in terms of energy used to just simply replace my ancient, relatively ancient refrigerator with a new and modern and efficient refrigerator. I haven't done it because that fundamentally works against my don't throw something away until it's broken thing, and I haven't figured out how to resolve those two different parts of my personality, but it is possible that you could change your energy consumption without having to make any dramatic changes in your lifestyle.
True.
Simply by concentrating on efficiency.
So while that's what it made me initially start thinking about the most, that wasn't really the focus of it. You know, he was talking about decreasing energy consumption, but it was more about better ways to produce energy, right? Cleaner energy.
Yeah, the thing I found most interesting, and I'm sure he's talked about this all over the place, and I'm just a Luddite and haven't been paying attention, but he wrote this simple equation, right? P times S times E times C equals CO2. So P is the population of the planet, right? And S is the services that they use. And so his basic premise is P is going up because we're having more people all the time. And S is going up, and it should go up because we want people to be able to use things like a refrigerator and an electric stove as opposed to, you know, cooking over a kerosene or charcoal fire or something like that. That's that's way more detrimental to their health. And then E is the energy used to provide those services for the people. So because people are going up and services are going up, energy is going to go up. In the developed parts of the world, the energy per person might go down as we get more efficient, right? Like if I finally choose to buy a new refrigerator, right? My efficiency will improve. Your efficiency might improve, but all of those improvements are probably going to be offset by additional people effectively coming into the modern.
Right. The P and S multipliers are getting bigger.
Right. Which leaves C, which is the carbon dioxide produced by that energy, right, that you use on the services for all the people. And so his basic premise is, if you want the right side of the equation, the amount of CO2 produced, one of those multiplying factors on the left side of the equation has to go to zero. And we don't want to have no people, and the people we do have, we want them to have services, and those services are going to take energy to run. So the only thing you have left with is figuring out how to produce energy in a way that produces no carbon dioxide. Which is a kind of a brilliantly simplistic way to think about this kind of overwhelming idea in a simple, attainable kind of way. So I thought that was key. I thought that was an important part of the message he was trying to deliver. Because it doesn't get lost in the politics of it all, right? One of the things that I hear people say and talk about a lot is in criticizing the, you know, green movement, if you will, is they want everybody to go, you know, commune with nature and live in the woods and grow all their own food, right? And almost nobody wants to do that, right? They want to come home to an air-conditioned house and flip on the lights and, you know, use the stove and have the washing machine wash clothes and turn on the TV, right, and relax with all of the modern comforts that they're used to. And so this approach recognizes that that's actually what most people want to do. And there's nothing wrong with that. We just have to figure out how to be able to do that in a better way. And so along with that, Bill Gates started something called the Breakthrough Energy Coalition, right? Because the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation focuses on health and human services traditionally, right? That's their main goal. But this Breakthrough Energy Coalition is a charitable organization whose purpose is to fund basic energy research, right? In thinking about this problem, he came to the conclusion that governments are not spending enough money on the R&D required to get us to, you know, zero carbon energy production fast enough. He suggests in his letter and in this Breakthrough Energy Coalition that it takes roughly 50 years for that, you know, for that next generation power source to come about, and that's too long. And so he thought, you know, I'm a rich guy, I know a couple other rich folk, and I can get access to various heads of states. Maybe I can talk a few of them into pooling some money together, and we can take, we can invest in like a early stage venture capital almost in some technologies that are promising in the lab, but need some more work, more investment to try to figure out, would they be promising in a commercial environment? Because the commercial producers are too risk averse, too conservative to invest their capital in those sorts of things. Traditionally, governments used to do this, but government budgets are tight everywhere, and so all of that funding gets cut. And then he was pleasantly surprised to get not just a couple of people to sign on, but something like, you know, 28 of the world's billionaires, and like 10 countries to sign up. And so they've pooled together serious amounts of money to be able to invest in this thing. And they seem to have, if you read through what their principles are, they understand that some of these things are going to take sustained investment for years and years and years and might not come to fruition at all. But you've got to try.
Right.
So, I don't know. It's a way to give you hope, right?
It is, definitely. And I guess that's why I initially focus on the E, because their focus on the C is the billions upon billions of dollars proposition.
Right.
Right. For me to focus on the C, you know, I can install solar panels, I can install a battery backup, I can use current available technology, which is not ideal, you know, is not perfect and is not zero carbon emission technology. And is still very expensive at a personal level.
Yes.
You know, so it's harder to get on board with that. But the E I can influence for me for now, right?
Right.
It's kind of like a in the meantime approach. That's the best thing I can do, is reduce my energy consumption while I'm waiting for, you know, a way to get my C to zero.
Yes. So this brings up, this makes me think of two things. One is the Mr. Money Mustache article I talked about.
I read that. That's very focused on your own personal energy consumption.
Right. In a very Mr. Money Mustache sort of way, which I enjoy that style. I understand that it rubs some people the wrong way, but that's fine. And so he's an advocate for, you know, stepping out of the rat ways, learning to enjoy life and leading a good life without necessarily doing it in the most energy intensive way possible. So he's a big advocate for living close to, you know, school and work and the grocery store and riding your bicycle everywhere and, you know, turning off the TV and going outside. And by doing these sorts of things, you know, he believes that it's easy for people to cut their energy consumption down by a tremendous amount, right? Learn to wear a sweater in the winter, learn to wear a t-shirt in the summer, you know, let the house be colder or warmer and just get used to it. It doesn't involve living badly. It just involves living differently than your neighbors. So there is something to that. But Mr. Money Mustache still uses energy, still runs a website that uses energy in a data center somewhere, and, you know, still has hundreds of thousands of people using energy on computers across the internet to come and read his website. So,
at the end of the article, he did talk a little bit about carbon offsets.
Right.
Buying carbon offsets. I don't really believe that's a great solution. That's a throw money at the problem kind of solution. That doesn't feel quite the same as actually reducing your carbon consumption. No. I don't know. How do you feel about carbon offsets?
Depends on what the offset is. If the offset is creating demand for solar energy, right, and then causing the building of the next solar energy installation, then it seems valuable to me as a way to aggregate, you know, small individual or small business size sums of money to pool it towards something that has a larger overall benefit.
So that's a way to get in there with the billionaires and influence change.
Well, certainly it's a way for you to influence change in a way that makes sense for whatever your situation is, right? If you're a small business and you feel strongly about climate change and want to reduce your carbon consumption, being able to spend, a few $100 of your business's profits to buy carbon offsets that are funneled into something that is working towards, you know, making a real change in the energy generation mix of the country, why shouldn't you be able to do that, right? Mm-hmm. That seems like the right thing to do. If it's just nebulous money that disappears into a hole where somebody somewhere is supposedly going to do something that's going to make the environment better, I don't know that that's valuable. Feels like you have to do the same kind of diligence with a carbon offset as you might do for any other charity.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of brings to mind, you know, at the most recent Apple media event, Lisa Jackson got up on stage and talked about their energy work, right? You know, 93% renewable energy. And what does that mean? It kind of feeds into this same thing, right? They're effectively operating on the same formula that Bill Gates listed in his annual letter. And so they're clearly not taking their energy usage to zero. It's clearly going up because they're building more iPhones and computers every year. And so they're trying to take their CO2 production for all the energy they use to zero. Right, so that whether implicitly or explicitly, they've come to the same conclusion about what the right answer is.
Right.
It's not less.
There's more people, more devices, more services.
It's more, but more in a carbon-free way.
Mm-hmm.
So, this led me, reading through all of this stuff, led me down the rabbit hole of nuclear fusion reading, which I find fascinating. We don't need to delve into it here. Most people don't want to talk about nuclear fusion in terms of its reality or not. I don't know. I thought it was that all of this stuff was kind of an interesting thing. That one last little note there I put in there. I don't know if you saw this. It's called burnstoves.com.
I did.
And so this is not a zero carbon energy production, but it's an energy efficiency thing, right? This is an improved wood stove so that people in places like Kenya can buy less charcoal and use it more efficiency and with less pollutants, because you get a more complete combustion that produces a hotter fire. So the people cooking over these stoves inhale fewer pollutants because of a better combustion. And it uses something like 45% less charcoal for the equivalent, cooking time, which will drive down the amount of money that people have to spend buying the charcoal, which should drive down the demand for charcoal, which is one of the biggest factors in the deforestation of places like Kenya, because they're cutting down all the trees to make charcoal so that people can cook food. You clearly don't want the people to starve. And they're using the resources that they have because they don't have electricity to run the, the $1,000 GE stove that we all have in our houses. So I thought that was important in the same way that trying to figure out how to get, energy production to a carbon zero state. This is like one of these relatively easy to do things that makes a lot of sense right now with well-known technology that we already know about, right? And they have a factory in Kenya to employ Kenyans to build these things locally, right? So you provide some people some real jobs making a thing that they need that improves their energy efficiency, which improves their environment and improves their health, and then gives them more resources for doing more things that are more important, like going to school and starting other businesses to improve their economy. So not all good acts with respect to energy have to revolve around, zero CO2 production.
Right. That's interesting. I'll have to look for it. You would appreciate it. There was a piece I heard on NPR several months ago that was talking about this problem, and it was talking about the amount of carbon that's being released by, they referred to it as like dark smoke burning or black smoke cooking or something like that. Like, they had a term for it, and it was anytime you're burning wood, you're burning charcoal, just for food preparation.
Right.
And reducing that. And it was shocking how much carbon, was being released just by that act of cooking.
Yep.
In other countries.
Along those same lines, a few years ago, here in the United States, we had rules go into effect for small engines, right? Emissions controls on small engines, like your lawnmower and snowblower and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of those things used to be two-stroke engines, which are very tiny and very powerful. And the emissions regulations have made that harder to do as a two-stroke. So a lot of that stuff is now four-stroke and cleaner. And I remember hearing at the time that even though it seemed inconvenient because all of these relatively cheap gas-powered things were going to be somewhat more expensive because they're going to have, you know, better emissions controls on them, apparently the cumulative effect of all of the you know, unburnt hydrocarbons that were spilling out of the exhausts of these relatively cheap but inefficient two-stroke engines was the equivalent to dumping an Exxon Valdez oil spill in the lakes, rivers, and streams of the United States every year. Like, that's how much pollution it was, because, you know, everybody who has a, you know, a weed whacker and a jet ski and a motorcycle and a ATV and a lawnmower and a
pressure washer
and a pressure washer and all of those little engines that you don't even really think
about.
I'm going
through my garage right now, everything that I fire up.
I mean, everybody has one of these and you don't use them a lot. You don't use them in the way that you might use your car, right? But everybody has one of these and they run for a few hours a year, and then you multiply that times 100 million and suddenly it's a really big number.
Do I have to feel guilty using my smoker now?
No.
Do I have to give up smoked meat? Please say no.
Well, we could talk about the ecological benefits of being a vegan, but
I don't know
that you want to do that. All right. Use less energy. Let's move on.
All right.
Let's talk about Japan.
Okay.
This is like the podcast of the weird.
Yeah. All right.
So I came across this article in the Smithsonian Magazine. It's old. It's like from 2004, like April of 2014. And it's about the Japanese have copied various American things and kind of made them better, but not in a bad way. Right? I mean, people are most aware of denim. Right, the Japanese effectively bought up all the old denim producing machines that we were using here up through the late 1950s and early 1960s. And then the United States textile industry moved on and got rid of those old, you know, full selvage machines and had different machines that could make even more and wider denim, but even cheaper, but not as good of quality. So the Japanese bought these old ones, and their basic culture of taking a craft to its almost illogical extreme, they've kind of latched on to some of these things. So this article talks about a guy that, what the heck of his name? The Takashi Tateno, who is pursuing making, you know, the first half of the 20th century American workwear, right? Not strictly just denim, but, you know, coats and trousers and all kinds of things, right? He's fascinated by it. So he's figuring out how to make them as well as they used to be made here and perhaps even better, and making them in Japan. There was some talk in here about a bourbon bar that has, you know, literally one of the best collections of really old American bourbons anywhere in the world. Like, stuff you can't get here anymore, right? And he used to come to the United States in the 1980s and drive around in the dark in the South looking for the lit signs of open bars and liquor stores. And it would ask him, you know, what's the abandoned stuff you've got in the basement? And he'd buy it. And he's got all of this stuff that isn't produced here anymore and is legitimately, you know, really old stuff. There was talk in here about a burger joint, Matsumoto Kozo, right? Makes has a Western style burger joint that in Japan that is potentially the most quintessential, you know, American burger joint in existence. It's just, it's in Japan. So I don't know, I was kind of fascinated by this notion that the Japanese have taken some of these most American of things and preserved them in a way that Americans haven't, right? America is all about throwing away the old and making the new.
Yeah. Do you think part of it has to do with just like an older culture? You know, America's still pretty young in a cultural sense. It's like they have the ability to recognize something as being, you know, the best or an ideal, something that's classic, you know, and then maintaining it, right? Instead of just moving on to the next thing. You know, workwear moved on in America and no one really recognized in the moment, you know, this is a classic
right.
thing, or this is an important design that should be made forever. You know, so now it's, you know, you go back and say, oh yeah, we should have stuck with that, or we should have kept that, but
I don't know.
You know,
certainly
it's too late.
Certainly Japanese culture has a very strong respect for traditions, but at the same time, it's lots of Japan takes place in the future, right? I mean, it may not be quite as true today, since the center of the smartphone making universe seems to have moved towards, you know, both either Cupertino or Mountain View with Google and Android. But, you know, for a long time, Japanese cell phones were always infinitely far advanced compared to the ancient, almost useless bricks that we used to have here. So there's a two sides to that culture that
yeah.
has a deep respect for tradition while embracing, you know, tomorrow's technology today. I don't know. I've seen videos in Japan. There are planer competitions, right? I mean, so a woodworking plane is a device that you has a effectively a razor on it, and you run it across a piece of wood, and it shaves a little bit off of it, right? So if you have a board that's a little bit too thick, you can plane it and make it a little bit thinner so that it'll slot in, right? In Japan, they have competitions to see who can produce the thinnest and longest continuous shavings. Right? They set up, you know, beams of wood as long as a gymnasium, and everybody brings in their old handheld planes that they've hand sharpened to the finest degree, and they very delicately run them along these long lines of wood, and they make these, you know, so thin as to be transparent shavings, and then they measure who made the longest one. That's
awesome.
Yeah.
It makes me think about when you were a kid, did you ever have one of those pencil sharpeners that you shove the pencil in and you twist and
yep.
twist and twist, and you could get this really long
yeah.
roll of shaving, you know, like that used to be a thing, like the longest, most perfect roll of pencil sharpened shaving you could do. Same
well,
concept.
Right. And if you had a crappy pencil, the wood wouldn't hold together very well.
Right.
Right. So I don't
know. That's interesting. I, you know, here when they were in the section that was talking about bourbon, they were talking about the Dylan bar where you go in and there's Bob Dylan
yep.
music videos and Bob Dylan, like it was devoted to Bob Dylan. You know, that's another case of, you know, a classic, like someone has latched onto this classic American singer and, you know, it's a form of like reverence.
Right.
Right. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure there are Dylan bars in America, but not with the same feel. Here you're more likely to find a Toby Keith bar or something, you know, like it's just like that idea of revering a classic something, whether it's a classic artist or a classic liquor, or a classic a fabric.
So I have to admit, the one thing I haven't come to understand or determine yet is is this just a Japanese and American thing? Or is this a Japanese thing such that they have figured out how to absorb and preserve and make their own the best bits of cultures from all over the planet. And it's just our American egotisticalness, right? Egoism, whatever the right word is, that only lets us see the bits of Americana that the Japanese have taken in. Like, have they figured out how to do something that is quintessentially French, and we just don't see it because Americans maybe don't value it?
I think it's that. I think it's the former. And it might have been this article, but it might have been another one that was talking about assimilating French, certain French cooking techniques. And, oh, it talked about stuff that they get from London. I can't remember now. It seemed to be more assimilating the best of other cultures into their own.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's powerful.
Yeah, definitely.
So...
Yeah, it was very cool. This is something that I was not aware of, that I found very interesting. And it made me want a burger and a glass of bourbon while wearing really great jeans.
Yeah, that's right. I need my $500 Japanese denim so that I can have a 100-year-old bourbon and a burger somewhere in Osaka. I don't know. All right, so let's move on to this New Yorker article about resilience. So did you finally get around to reading this thing?
I did.
So I found this article to be most interesting and helpful in a lot of ways for, you know, things going on in my personal life. But the basic premise here is, this is kind of a review of resiliency research.
Research, which I didn't know was a thing. That was interesting to me at first, is that they're talking about these people who have been researching resiliency for years.
And so what they mean by resiliency is, the person who kind of started this field was looking at it in terms of school children. And so it would be children who are succeeding despite the long odds, you know, so kids for whom might be coming from a home that has a bunch of challenges. Either it has, you know, alcoholic parents, or, you know, living in abject poverty or something like that, and still they're overcoming those problems and figuring out how to excel in school and then eventually in life. And this, the start of this research really let people think about, trauma and traumatic events in different ways. Apparently prior to this, all the research used to focus on how does some sort of traumatic event make you vulnerable and weak? And this research focuses on how do people be, you know, strong and resilient despite these traumatic things that happen to them. And a couple of interesting things have kind of fallen out of it, which is resiliency is something that's trainable. And it seems to have to do with effectively your point of view. So if something bad happens to you and you internalize it and make yourself think that
it's your fault,
and nothing can ever be good again, then you're stuck, right? You have damaged yourself, and you're going to struggle to overcome it. But if you can look at a bad thing that's happened and say, well, that sucks, I'll try to do better next time, this doesn't mean I'm an inherently bad or worthless person. Effectively, if you frame this issue or this event in your own mind the right way, you have a much better chance of getting past it and still being happy, healthful, and useful as a person. Doesn't mean that you can't be overcome. Everybody has a breaking point, right? You might just be unlucky. You might be a naturally resilient person, but, you know, four bad things happen to you in a row, and finally that fourth one is water over the dam, and you can't overcome it anymore. But the fact that it's a learnable skill, I thought was valuable and interesting.
That was my key takeaway from it too. And, you know, they had three specific techniques about, you know, determining the context or framing the situation. And, you know, the first one was recognizing external forces versus internal. That was the, you know, it's not my fault. You know, right. This has happened to me. I have not caused this. The second one was global to specific. So it was basically narrowing the issue to say, you know, this is the thing that has happened, not this is some generalization about the direction of my life.
Right.
You know, this is a very specific thing. And then it was permanent, the permanence of it. Like, is this something that has to be permanent, or I can change this? It is a temporary setback kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting, that aspect of it. That's the part that connected with me the most, thinking about how, you know, having a woe is me attitude, you know, assessing a situation in the most negatively, you know, the negative way possible. Mm-hmm. I'm guilty of that frequently, of negativity and, you know, negative self-talk.
Right. Yet you also have a history of overcoming all of that, right? You go through these periods where you say, you know what, I've had enough of that and I'm going to get fit and get healthy, and you do it. So you clearly know that you can change your circumstances, right?
Yeah, and I think I'm the kind of person where lots of times it takes time. Like, it takes a lot of time. I like to maybe, you know, wallow and, you know, not be proactive. That was the key takeaway from the article, is that it needs to be a proactive thing.
Yep.
Like, I need to say, I'm going to change how I'm thinking about this, not just wait until I naturally process it and get to that point, you know, where I change how I think about it. And that was a key point in the article, is that it's something that you can actively do, not just wait until your, you know, innate resiliency kicks in, right? It's like, I'm going to develop the skill to be resilient.
Yeah. In reading this, I kind of wondered how this relates to the advice you read on the internet from time to time about making yourself accountable to someone else, right? So if you say, you know, I want to go to the gym 3 times a week, right? Saying that to yourself is one thing, but, you know, telling your friend or your friends or the world via your blog, hey, I'm going to go to the gym 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and then have to report back to them on whether you succeed or not. I wonder if it's that act of, I don't know if speaking aloud is the right term, but the act of
putting it out there in the universe,
of saying it to more than just yourself, is the act of resiliency that you need, right? Like, if that's the part where hearing yourself say it either makes it true or not to you, right? Because if you're sitting down with your friend and you're like, man, I really want to go to the gym 3 times a week, and they're like, oh yeah, that's great, you should really do that, or you say that and you're like, who am I kidding, I'm never going to do that, right? Like, you kind of know at that moment, right, when you hear yourself say it, whether you're really committed to it or not. I don't know, it seemed like there's some sort of,
I think there is a connection there. Yeah,
interconnection.
I mean, anything's possible in my head. I can do anything in my head.
Sure.
Sometimes saying it out loud really puts a point on whether or not it's possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Go read the article. I find it fascinating. All right, so now let's talk about this last one, right? Siri in crisis, yeah. And so this is a...
Which I thought by the title of the piece, Siri in Crisis, it was going to be a whole other thing. I thought it was going to be about...
Some doom and gloom about Apple.
Right, about how terrible Siri is and how it hasn't improved over the years and Google's doing better and yada yada. It was not about that at all.
No, so this is a... Somebody wrote for Medium about a... A Journal of the American Medical Association internal medicine study that showed that the smartphone AIs from everybody, right? Apple, Samsung, Google, Microsoft, they really don't know what to do during a crisis when an individual is in crisis. So if you ask... You know, if you say to Siri, I was just sexually assaulted, what do I do? Siri doesn't know what to do, right? And, this article goes on to talk about people are programming these for delight, which is not a very deep level of understanding, right? Like, it's almost easier to say, you know, what was the score of yesterday's Cubs game? That's an easier thing to figure out than trying to determine what somebody really means when they say they were sexually assaulted. But this article, this study is suggesting, as it turns out, figuring out how to help people who are really in trouble is maybe even more important and trying to figure out how to make me happy by knowing what the sports scores were yesterday.
So setting delight aside, I'll come back to delight. I have a problem with delight. But I feel like the article went a little too far saying, basically it was trying to say that Siri is fundamentally a flawed technology. Like, it broadly generalized that, you know, AI can never, you know, work in this type of situation, that kind of thing. I think that was a little overblown. I think there's a lot of problems with Siri providing advice in a situation like that. I think, what if you said to Siri, I'm having a heart attack, what do I do? I don't think your phone should be providing medical advice. What if I'm misrecognizing my symptoms and it tells me to start, you know, doing something that ends up being the wrong advice? I know that's a little bit different, but it's one of those things that once you start saying, oh, you know, Siri should be able to handle every situation, I don't think it should. I mean, maybe it just says, you know, call an ambulance or call a medical professional or something. You know, I'm sure that there are smart engineers at Apple and this had come across their... across their to-do list or their plate, and they were like, you know, should we be providing advice in this particular situation, not knowing the circumstances, you know, not knowing what's going on?
I'm sure the lawyers are involved here, right? And, you know, should Siri provide medical advice? On the one hand, the answer is yes. If you don't know what to do when you think you're having a heart attack, Siri should say, you should call emergency services. Shall I dial 911 for you? Right. That should clearly be what it should do, because in a lot of ways, it's the Siri is the thing you have right there next to you that can take an action for you. On the other hand, what does that mean from a liability perspective? Right. What if you call emergency services when it wasn't warranted? What if you don't when it should have been, but how would you know? You'd have to go to court and attempt to defend yourself against, how was I supposed to figure it out?
Right.
Which is a moment in time statement about the capacity of natural language processing and an artificial intelligence, which is both a moving target and would be impossible to explain to a jury of your peers. Right, unless your peers all
right.
have computer science degrees. So
So on the question whether or not Siri should be making meaningful recommendations in this case, I guess I'm torn on that. Like, I don't think she necessarily should or shouldn't. Like, I mean, I think a measured approach is used. On the delight issue, you know, they had one here where, like, oh, what was it? The question was, Siri, I don't know what to do. I was just sexually assaulted. And Siri responds, one can't know everything, can one?
Right.
That's the cuteness. To me, that's something you can fix. Right? That's a tweak to the algorithm. Like, don't give smart-ass answers, you know, when there's a possible, you know, real problem happening.
Yeah, but it requires the same knowledge, right? You still have to know that what was just told to you is something that's truly serious and that you're choosing not to respond to it. And so how do you respond with sensitivity?
So then maybe the answer is you get rid of a lot of the delight, the joking, completely. And I wouldn't disagree with that. I kind of have a problem with this delight factor. Like when my browser crashes and I get an, oh snap, something bad happened.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that seems to have been something that's going out of style. But here 5-6 years ago, like cute error messages was a big thing. Google kind of pioneered a lot of that. Oops, cuteness. And it really irritates me because I'm just like, fix your junk. You know, don't tell me oops or show me a unicorn.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same thing with Siri, right? She can't answer my question and give some, you know, smart, ironic answer. Not helpful.
It can be a double-edged sword. A place I worked for once had some of these in its emails with its customers. It had some of these, you know, clever and cute sayings that used to get inserted. And, you know, occasionally you know, the computer would choose in some transactional email with a customer some clever and cute statement, but it would be, you know, the customer would be doing something like, you know, it'd be in relation to a funeral or some sort of, mm-hmm. you know, unhappy time in their lives. And you would get an email from them that would say, you know, this cuteness is really inappropriate here. And it's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
So you run the risk of being tone deaf, which is really what you're arguing for here, right? But it's a trade-off, right? I mean, there's the percentage of time that you're tone deaf is probably pretty small, right? Depending on what it is. Now, you probably don't want your medical insurance company to be sending you...
Oh, snap, we didn't process your claim.
Yeah, that's right. You don't want any cuteness there, but they know that the context, right, in processing medical insurance claims is different than the context of, you know, people asking Siri crazy questions all the time. So I don't know. I mean, do you want Siri to be your average corporate lawyer in all of the responses you get? Because that seems like a joyless world to live in, right? If Siri turns into RoboCop.
I don't need Siri to entertain me. I have plenty of sources of entertainment in my life. I need Siri to answer questions with legitimate answers. I very rarely use Siri, actually, to be honest, because I think it's completely useless. So in this particular case, I maybe don't care.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like the utility of it is maybe compromised by the entertainment value of it.
Well, we're certainly in early stages. My guess is in 10 years, when you say to Siri, hey, I was just sexually harassed or assaulted, what should I do? You're going to get a very helpful, meaningful answer, right? And a stream of questions, and you're going to be connected to the right people that you should be connected to help you. I think it's inevitable.
Mm-hmm. It's not happening very fast. Not at Apple, at least.
I don't know if that's true. Right? Because the fundamental question is, how do you derive deeper meaning from the context of what's going on? And I think Apple and Google and Microsoft are working on that problem quite a lot, right? I think they see, you know, the value of a general solution to that problem being key to their continued survival for the next 50 years. You know, everybody wants a Star Trek computer that just magically knows when you're talking to the computer, and it magically knows what it is that you mean when you use these nebulous words. So smart brains are working on it, and money is being spent trying to figure it out. And the closer you get to being perfect in that space, the easier it is to figure out how to provide the right answer in something other than light and fluffy stuff, right? When people are having serious moments in their lives, they're going to turn more and more to their phone to get the answer. And that AI on the phone is going to provide it for them.
So the most unfortunate thing about the article, did you start reading the comments?
Never read comments on the internet.
No. That's good. It immediately turned into a gender battle between the author and male commenters.
Oh, jeez.
As things tend to do on the internet.
I don't understand that.
I don't get it either. You know, I just try and stay...
Like, I wonder, am I missing some sort of male gene that feels compelled to insult women on the internet? Like, I've literally never understood that. And I'm not trying to sound all high and mighty. I'm literally befuddled, right? Like, I see people do that, and I'm like, what the F is wrong with you? Why would you... How is that helpful? How is that even relevant?
I think I can honestly say...
Don't get me on a hobby horse, because I'll be riding it all day.
I don't think I've ever commented somewhere on the internet in public. Like on an article, on Reddit. Like I don't do that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I guess I have on Hacker News before. That's probably the only place. And I always think like, this is what I would say about this article, but I don't feel compelled to go say it and yell at somebody about it.
I do it almost never.
Yeah.
If I do it, it's almost always at a place where there's a community of people on a specific topic. Like, it would never occur to me to write a comment on an article on Washington Post or the New York Times or Medium, right? Because this is like raw internet, right? Like, this is the unwashed masses of the internet showing up to read your comment. I'm like, there's no room for nuance here, right? I don't feel like I understand who I would be writing it to. I have occasionally taken the time to send emails to authors of articles. Lots of times I get a response. And I think the fact that you're not just yelling at them in a comment form separates you from the great unwashed masses of the internet. But comments on the internet are almost always useless.
Yeah, I tend to like to read them though, just for the like entertainment value. New York Times does pretty good. I don't know if you've ever seen on the Times, like they have a good system for highlighting good comments. And they even will do like a weekly digest, like here are the 10 best comments on articles that were in the New York Times this week.
Ars Technica has a tendency to do that. Once an article gets a day or two old, you get down to the bottom, they've got
featured
a couple of the best comments up there, and that's fine.
I mean, sometimes it's providing key information that wasn't in the article, or a perspective that was glossed over or not, you know, carefully presented in the article.
Yep. And that's handy. It's not uncommon for me to read blog posts places where somebody, you know, if you're coming to it a couple days later, the author will have updated and say, you know, with a sentence that says, oh, and our reader commented that, you know, there's this thing that I didn't think about, or there's this additional thing to think about in addition to what I'm espousing here. And so in that way, it's better, but you know, the signal to noise ratio is very high.
Yeah.
So
bringing up the New York Times, I got to complain about one thing today. So I have a digital subscription.
You being resilient or
to the New York Times. Yeah. I didn't cause this. This has happened to me.
Okay, so it's external.
I have a subscription to, you know, digital subscription to the New York Times that I signed up for, I don't know, like 6 months ago.
Yep.
And it was one of those deals where they had like a teaser rate. It was like $3 or $4 a month. I can't remember.
Yep.
And then eventually it was going to increase in price. And I never do those. And I don't know why I did it, because it really irritates me. Well, now it's increased and it's like $15 a month. And so I'm not going to pay $15 a month for it. As I start looking at all of the monthly subscriptions I have, yeah, you know, it's getting to be a lot. And so I was like, I don't need to pay $15 a month. I don't get that value out of it, I don't think.
That's New York Times saying we're as valuable as HBO Now.
Correct. So and whether or not, I don't want to debate whether or not it's worth $15 a month. My complaint is, so I go into my account, I want to cancel my subscription, and I'm kind of thinking maybe, you know, they'll offer a cheaper rate or something if you stay on. So you go click cancel. They say, are you sure you want to cancel? You're going to miss out on this, this, this. You got to click again. I'm sure I want to cancel. Call us at 1-800 blah, blah, blah.
Really?
Really.
Now you're just pissed.
Wow. I mean, you talk about, and the New York Times often kind of bandies about how they are, you know, they get digital, right? Like they get digital subscriptions. They're really,
no, they
they're really making it happen on the internet.
Yeah.
If I have to pick up a phone and call you to do anything with my subscription,
yeah,
you're
fair.
Doing it wrong. So that, I just couldn't believe that.
Wow. So you called them.
I haven't yet because I hate calling people.
Like, it worked.
So now it's been on my to-do list for a couple of days. I mean, I have my subscription till like the middle of April anyway, so it's not like an imminent thing. But so there's two problems there. A, this idea of you get a certain rate for a certain period of time and then it increases. And I don't like that kind of thing, you know, and I feel like we've moved beyond that. Like Netflix has a flat price. HBO Go has a flat price. Apple Music has a flat price. Free trial, maybe, you know, you could argue yep. that's the same deal. They're getting you in the door, whatever. That's somehow different than some sort of graduated pricing that they want to happen over time once you've forgotten about it, you know, and until you yeah. see the number on your credit card statement, you won't take action.
Right.
So I hate that. And then to make you call to cancel the subscription is just bizarre.
Yes. The thing you're going to have to remember is whomever you end up speaking to on the phone did not set the policy.
Oh, no. They're going to get it.
While you may want to unload on them, they're probably just some poorly paid intern.
I'll call when I'm in a good mood, I promise.
No, you won't. Because as soon as you dial, right? You're going to be angry. I mean, did you write the phone number down? Or are you going to have to go through this process again?
I'm going to have to go through it again.
Yeah. See, you're going to, they've primed the pump for you to call in a fit of rage, right? You're going to,
or maybe I'll just pay $15 a month for the rest of my life and bravo New York Times.
I wonder if you could just like occasionally, I don't know, like attach all those stupid things to a credit card or something that you just turned off. Like eventually you'd be like, I'm tired of paying this money and I don't want to cancel. I'm just going to call up American Express and tell them, cancel this card, stop accepting payments from it, and just reject it all. I wonder if that would be some way you could do it. Just once a year, you just turn off all the stupidity and you'd naturally go back and resubscribe to everything that was valuable to you.
Yeah.
That's kind of like a burned, you know, scorched earth policy, but
I think it's probably bad to go down that route because eventually you're going to hit somebody who turns it over to collections or has some automated process for trying to make you pay because you've agreed to a contract, you know, blah, blah.
So this is why I know that people like Bill Gates are better people than I am, because if I had Bill Gates' money, I would invite that and just sue people out of existence. There are so many companies that I would just buy and shut down because
yeah.
you are too stupid to exist. Right? That's how I would spend my billions of dollars.
While I too would derive great satisfaction from that, I'm glad it's Bill Gates who has the billions.
That's right. So, all right, another podcast come and gone. Anything else?
That's all I got.
Bye-bye.
See you next week.